I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a rancher in Wyoming who has had it up to here with the mad rush for natural gas. Marjorie West has lived on the same ranch in the Powder River Basin for over 50 years. Now, some time back, she and her husband agreed to let the oil companies come on the land to drill some test wells. Marjorie says her family made a bit of money, but the oilmen found nothing. What she didn't know was that the oil companies would turn around and sell those leases to natural gas companies. And for the past 10 years, Marjorie says the gas companies have torn up the ranch land and wrecked the water table. She's hired lawyers and experts and complained to politicians, and she says the gas companies aren't too happy with her, but she doesn't care anymore.
They made me angry, and now they're angry with me, but I don't care. You know, what they are doing is wrong.
What happens when the hunt for gas goes sour? I'll talk with Marge West right after the news. A bit chilly when you got up this morning? Did you turn up the furnace? Feel the warm air from the vents? You know, while we all complain about the cost of oil and gas these days, some people in the country are actually paying an even heftier price. Marjorie and Bill West own a ranch in northwest Wyoming, 13,000 acres on Spotted Horse Creek in the Powder River Basin. Marge and Bill grow wheat and raise cattle. That land's been in the family for generations. These days, Marjorie says, the land's been crisscrossed with power lines and new roads as gas men in their pickups prowl for places to punch new wells.
If you go on the highway a few miles and you look back over where our county road is, you can see a dust cloud hanging over that road for miles and miles.
Marge West will tell you that she and her husband were the ones who decided some years back to let the oil companies in. Today, they wish they'd never done it. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Marjorie West was born and raised in Wyoming. She's not saying to anyone that oil and gas companies shouldn't drill. All she's ever said is, do it right. Do it without tearing up the land and flooding it with foul water. Treat my land, she says to the gas companies, the way you'd treat your own.
If I were to go into their front yard and drill a well and mess up their property and lower the value of it, I would be in jail so fast my head would be spinning. But you see, in Wyoming, oil and gas and coal take precedence. We love the ranch, and we don't want to see it destroyed.
Marjorie West moved to that ranch over 50 years ago. She was 18, just married. She remembers the first time she saw the land along Spotted Horse Creek.
It was very pretty. As you go along the highway, it looks fairly flat. But once you get off the highway a couple of miles, there's a lot of breaks. There's a lot of valleys and hills and rocky hilltops and pine trees and cedar trees. It's very pretty.
Very untouched land, I would imagine, back then.
It was. It was. Our road wasn't, they graded it, but it was a dirt road. A number of times going to the ranch in the spring and in the winter, we would get stuck and have to walk to the nearest neighbors.
No waiting for a passing car.
No. In fact, if somebody drove past the ranch, we would all run outside and say, oh, look, there's so-and-so. I'll bet he's going to Sheridan or to Buffalo or to Gillette. It was a big deal.
How close was your nearest neighbor back then?
About 5 miles.
And no electricity, no phones. You really were on your own.
Oh, yes. You know, we didn't run to the grocery store every day.
Tell me something, Marge. Was that in any way intimidating for you? You were 18 years old when you were married and moved onto the land with Bill, and, you know, you're pretty well cut off from the kind of city life that you've grown up with.
Right, I was, but no, it wasn't intimidating. I've always loved it.
Did you spend a lot of time riding or walking or exploring the land there?
I used to ride some. I was never what you would call a horsewoman because I was raised in town and didn't have the opportunity. But after our children were born, then I took care of them while they were small and did the cooking and this type of thing.
While Marge ran the home, Bill took care of the ranch. But as all people in Wyoming know, it's not just what's on the land that matters. There are oil and gas companies always searching for places to drill for farmers and ranchers who'll let them put in a few test wells.
These landmen, they call them, the representatives of the oil company, and they'd come in and say, we want to lease X number of acres for $10 an acre the first year and $1 an acre after that for 10 years. Boy, that was a great deal, you know. That was something we didn't have to work and struggle to get. And there were times when nobody had our land leased, but other times it was leased to oil companies.
And how many acres do you have there, Marge?
13,000.
So you could take a few hundred acres and set them aside for the oil companies to come in and punch a few holes, and it wouldn't necessarily mess up your cattle operation or your growing, right?
Right. Well, they never did find any oil on us. You know, they had come in and drill a test well, and there was nothing there. Well, we still got to keep that dollar an acre for the next 9 years. So it was a good deal, we thought.
It added up over time, did it?
Yeah, it did.
And once you'd sold those leases to the oil companies to come in and look for oil, and once those leases expired, did the rights to the land and the subsurface rights revert back to you and Bill?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So it's not like you were taking that land and opening it up to exploration for years to come, right?
Oh, no. No. And, you know, when the coal bed methane gas people came in on us, they bought old oil leases, and that's how they got on our land.
They could buy them from the oil companies. They didn't have to negotiate with you?
Absolutely. These various mineral companies buy and sell leases among themselves, and they do not have to inform the landowner.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. What happened with this Wyoming ranch land gets a bit complicated. As Marge West told me, they own 13,000 acres, but they don't own all of the subsurface rights. Some belong to them, some to the state, some to the federal government. And as Marge was telling me, once a lease is sold to one company, then that lease can be bought and sold by others. If the energy companies find something, they get to stay on. Marge West says she never had any trouble with the oil men. It was the gas companies. You see, they'd found this way to get gas out of Wyoming's underground coal beds. But it was messy work. The water has to be pumped out of the coal. It was then spilled on the land. And then those underground empty pockets would fill up with methane gas. They call it coal bed methane extraction. Marge says she and her husband weren't prepared for the men who work for the gas companies.
They're a different breed. They will come in and tell you anything.
Tell me about one of your experiences. Tell me a story about one of them who came.
Okay. They drilled some methane wells close to our house, and that caused our house water well to dry up because they have to pump out the water in order for the methane gas to raise and for them to collect it. So they did drill us a new well. And they said, oh, this is going to be fabulous. You are going to be able to raise a garden. You can have lawn. You can have anything you want. Well, there was and is a lot of water. However, it has a very high salt content, and it turns the ground white and hard as a brick. You can't raise anything. My front yard is now gravel. And, you know, they make it sound so wonderful. When they first come, you think, hooray! But then the reality sets in. And, you know, they said, now we'll put this water in your reservoirs. And this has been a problem throughout the years. You know, the reservoirs go way down in a dry summer, and we thought, woohoo, hallelujah, we're going to have water for the cattle, it's going to be fantastic. But we did not realize they were going to fill the reservoirs completely full Then if you have a sudden summer storm, the reservoir washes out.
You mean you'll actually lose the banks that hold the water?
Exactly.
My understanding of methane extraction, the kind that they're doing, Marge, is that, and I'll try and be, I have to take this in a kind of simple way because that's the way I understand it. In effect, what they do is they pump as much of the groundwater out as they possibly can in the hopes that they create these cavities that then fill up with methane gas that they can recover, right?
That's basically it, yeah.
So there's a lot of water coming out of the ground at one time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they want to either run it into reservoirs, which overflow, or they want to run it down draws, like into the Powder River, into the Tongue River. It then flows into Montana. Those people don't want that salty water. And I don't blame them one little bit, because I don't want it either. You know, this water can be treated. It can be pumped to municipalities. I know Sheridan has water rationing in the summer. Gillette has water rationing. I'm sure Buffalo probably has water rationing. I think there are probably very few towns in Wyoming who do not have water rationing. This water can be treated, this bad stuff taken out of it, and the water used and kept in the state.
You don't have to talk to me too long about the dangers of a drought. I mean, we're living one here in North Carolina. They're going through them in the Southwest right now. In Wyoming, if I understand it correctly, I mean, you're perpetually short of water. So to have all this groundwater drawn out at one time and pumped into the rivers, I mean, that's got to have some fairly significant long-term effects on the land, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, once all this methane extraction is finished and these companies leave, and they will leave, what are we going to do for water? How are we going to water our cattle? You know, when the groundwater is gone, who is going to be able to afford a $100,000 well to water their cattle? And it'll take more than one well. I had a friend that I went to high school with say to me, "Well, what do you care what it's doing to the land? You're making a lot of money." Yes, we are making money. We're not making a lot of money, but we are making some money. But, you know, if I could blink my eyes and put the situation back to where it was in 1998, I would do it. It isn't worth the money having your land destroyed.
Marge West says these days the politicians and the business people seem to be convinced that cheap gas is what matters, even more than the land. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There is a new push on to drill for oil and gas here in the U.S., and it's a direction that's coming right from the top.
And here we have a serious problem. America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world. The best way to break this addiction is through technology. Since 2001, we have spent nearly $10 billion to develop cleaner, cheaper, and more reliable alternative energy sources. And we are on the threshold of incredible advances.
These incredible advances that President Bush was talking about in his 2006 State of the Union speech are not just wind and solar power. Remember the president talking about cleaner, cheaper, and more reliable energy sources? Those include this push for coal bed methane extraction, and you hear about it in industry videos.
With both environmental sensitivities and North America's natural gas consumption on the rise, the question is how to recover this huge methane resource in the most efficient and cost-effective manner with a minimal environmental footprint.
Marjorie and Bill West say that the environmental footprint from the gas companies on their ranch is beyond what's acceptable. In the late 1990s, coal bed methane production came to Wyoming, and Marge and Bill's land changed dramatically.
We have now roads all over our land. They have brought in electricity to run all their pumps. You know, electricity is a bad thing because when they put in a power line, they don't want to go over the rocky hills. They want to go where the land is nice and flat, you know, where it's easy for them. Well, of course, that's where my husband raises wheat.
Marge West says the worst effect of the gas drilling isn't the roads or the power lines. This kind of extraction involves pumping out millions of gallons of water from the underground aquifers. Then methane gas seeps into those empty pockets, which can later be tapped and put into a pipeline. The trouble is with the water. What to do with it? It's so salty, Marge says. It was like poison when it was pumped into the creeks and the lowlands.
We had better than 200 old stand cottonwood trees, and they were very large. And it was just beautiful. My husband can remember having picnics under these trees when he was 5 or 6 years old, and he's 75 now. It was home to a lot of wildlife, a lot of birds, deer you could see most any time. And that's where our hay meadows are located. And of course, it was green all year. And in Wyoming, you don't have dry land that's green all year.
Marjorie says their land was also being flooded and damaged by gas companies that weren't even working on their ranch.
When the methane started, we did not have a land use agreement with Devon Energy, which was producing gas on land above ours. They sent all this water down. It flooded our hay meadows. This salty water will change the molecular structure of the soil. It won't let the water seep down, and it won't let water come up through the bottom. So it basically, it kills the soil. It killed better than 200 old stand cottonwood trees. We lost 75 to 80 acres of prime hay meadow, which had been alfalfa and native grasses. And we finally did get a surface use agreement with Devon Energy, which was the one putting all this water down on us. And in that surface use agreement, it says that they will restore our hay meadows to their previous condition by March of 2002. It's a good thing we haven't been holding our breaths. They have done nothing.
But Marge, if they're not living up to the agreements in the lease or the agreements in a surface land use agreement, can't you just change the lock on the fence and say, stay off our land. You guys are not living up to your part of the contract.
No. In order to enforce the contract, you have to hire lawyers, you have to hire soil scientists, you have to hire water scientists. And as the landman from Devon told Bill, we'll keep you tied up in the courts for years. And in Wyoming, I'm very sorry to say, the courts are very likely to rule against you. Therefore, you have your lawyer fees, plus you have their legal fees. It's pretty much a no-win situation.
How much money have you guys spent on lawyers and your own soil and water scientists?
Well, I don't want to say the amount, but it is far more than I had ever thought we would spend on legal fees.
Yeah, I'm less interested in the exact amount and more thinking to myself, okay, you've got some money coming in from the gas that's being pumped out of your land, and you end up, you know, hiring lawyers to protect what's left of it. When you balance it out, what does it look like?
It doesn't look very pretty. And, you know, we had a neighbor say to us, oh, don't do anything to make these CBM companies angry with you. You just go along with whatever they want to do. Well, you know what? They made me angry. And now they're angry with me. But I don't care. You know, what they are doing is wrong. And our land will never be restored to what it was. Never. But if I can help even one person save their land, then I feel like I've done some good.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. It's been nearly 10 years since Spotted Horse Creek was first flooded by water from the gas wells, killing those cottonwood trees. I asked Marge West about that part of her ranch in Wyoming to tell me what it looks like today.
The part of the hay meadow that was destroyed, you come down this long hill and you look over to the left, and it's beautiful. It is bright green, and if you didn't know better, you'd think, wow, this is terrific stuff. However, when you get over to it, it is kochia, which is an extremely salt-tolerant weed. Cattle will not eat it. Wildlife will not eat it. And it's just, in the fall when it ripens, I would be willing to bet there are 20,000 seeds per plant. Once it gets going, it's bad, bad stuff.
It's changing the whole ecology of your land, is what you're saying.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
And the trees, Marge, what do they look like now?
Well, they're gone. Bill has cut them down, and we've had ads running in the Gillette paper in the winter. Free firewood, come and get it, you know. Because if you don't cut them down, they will fall down, and you still have to drag them off the meadows and clean up the branches and twigs that fall off the tree when it falls.
You're talking about the kind of forest grove that, as you mentioned earlier, is home to a lot of wildlife. Have you noticed the effect of the methane gas water on the wildlife on the ranch?
Now, you know, it has not seemed to affect the deer or the antelope.
They probably like the salt.
I don't know. They may. But the birds are another story. We used to have sage grouse, they do their spring strutting and display. Bill saw one sage grouse this fall. He hadn't seen any for several years. We had a little flock of sharp-tailed grouse behind my house, and every winter I would throw out seeds to them so they would have something to eat. I started out with 33, and this winter I'm down to 3. And they, you know, they get on the county road. And, of course, these methaners, when they're traveling to and from work, they want to get back home or to work as quickly as they can. So they go faster than they should. And a lot of the birds get killed. And I feel very badly about that. Because, you know, when it was just a few cars on the road, we would slow down if there were birds in the road, and we would avoid hitting them. It's sad.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Marge and Bill West also lost their own drinking water when the gas company started messing with the underground water table. The well they used was spoiled. The gas company drilled them a new one 1,200 feet down. Marge says that water's no good either.
It's terrible.
You can't drink it even if it's coming from that far down.
Oh, no. See, this is what I had thought. I had thought the deeper you get, the better your water is. No. At least in our area, the deeper you go, the saltier it is.
Did it make you sick initially?
Oh, yeah. I tried it. And believe me, I was the very favorite customer of the company that manufactures Imodium. And I thought, I'm not going to try this again. So for a while, we hauled water from Gillette, and then we did get the reverse osmosis units so that we can drink the water.
Marge, I want to go back to something you were saying a few moments ago about, you know, if you could go back and undo all this. I'm thinking to myself that there will be people listening to us who say, you know what, Marge West, you kind of reaped what you sowed. You tried to make a little bit of money by leasing land to the oil companies, and it didn't really go as well as you'd hoped. But, I mean, it was your choice in the first place.
And they're right. They are right. But we had no idea. We didn't even know about this methane gas. But they are right. We did lease to the oil companies.
Do you feel in some way personally responsible then for the damage that's been done?
Yes.
So when you look out the window at the way that your ranch has changed since the methane people got there, are you seeing your ranch as kind of like a cautionary tale for what other people should avoid, or is it more like an example of what's happening all over Wyoming?
Both. Both.
I mean, other people are going through this same thing that you are, right? You're not just unlucky people who had it.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, we're not the only ones. Yeah. We're not the only ones. And, you know, some people are willing to take the land degradation and say, good for us, we've got some money. But, you know, our children are on the ranch. Hopefully our grandchildren will be on the ranch. We love the ranch, and we don't want to see it destroyed.
I know that you made a submission to a Senate committee on this very issue, Marge. It was about this time, 4 years ago.
Correct.
What were you hoping for? What were you? Were you just saying, you know, beware? Let's not let this continue. Or are you saying, hey, you know, we didn't get what we thought we were going to get. We need a little bit of help here.
You know, I think we were saying, let's be cautious. Let's do this right. This gas has been under the surface for thousands of years. It's not going to suddenly go bad unless we get it out tomorrow. Let's advance our technology so that we don't harm the land. We keep our water.
You mean do it right or don't do it at all?
Exactly. Exactly.
And did you find that you got a sympathetic ear from the senators?
No. How's that for an answer?
Well, you know, it's a curious thing for me because I've actually heard from people in the West, in places like Colorado and Wyoming, that, you know, there is a price for energy self-sufficiency. And if we have to punch a bunch of holes in the northern Alaska tundra and, you know, mess up the land where the caribou are, that's the price of being self-sufficient in oil. And if we have to take some of that pristine ranch land in Wyoming and turn it up and turn it salty and dusty, but we get self-sufficiency in oil and gas, maybe that's the price of it. What do you say to people who make that argument?
I say it isn't worth it, but the gas can be produced in such a manner that there is not all this degradation. Yes, it costs a little bit more for the companies. However, they are making record profits. And, you know, if I were to go into their front yard and drill a well and mess up their property and lower the value of it, what do you think would happen to me? I can tell you, I would be in jail so fast, my head would be spinning. But you see, in Wyoming, oil and gas and coal take precedence.
Marge and Bill West still live on the ranch. They still work the land and raise cattle. Their daughter and her family are there as well.
They love it out there. You know, they have horses. They're into 4-H. They're into pole bending and barrel racing, and they help with the branding and get the gathering.
Do you think that your grandchildren will be able to enjoy that land in the same way that you did?
You know, I hope they will be able to. I don't know. If we keep drawing all this water out of the underground aquifers and wasting it, they're not going to be able to make a living. Because you have to have water to live.
That's your real fear, isn't it, Marge? Not the salt that comes from last month's spillover, but where's that water going to come from in 20 years or in 50 years' time?
Oh, yes, yes. You know, I think that one day, when all is said and done, the people in Wyoming are going to wake up and realize that the water had far more value than the gas. And it's gone.
Marge and Bill West live on a ranch in the Powder River Basin in northwest Wyoming.
There's a full moon rising in the prairie sky tonight. Lord, it's good to be on my way home.
Over that horizon, she keeps the home fires burning bright. I'm going back to my Powder River home, where the river winds from the big horns up above, and the clear moon shines on the prairie that I love. It's the closest place to heaven this cowboy's ever known. I'm going back to my Powder River home. Traveling around the country for a dozen years or more. Funny how your point of view can change. I finally found the rainbow that I've been searching for. It's right above my home out on the range, where the river winds.
We have some pictures of the West Ranch and Spotted Horse Creek on our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story.
It's the closest place to heaven this cowboy's ever known. I'm going back to my Powder River home. I'm going back to my Powder River home.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And this next story came to me courtesy of Ken Newhams at the Duluth Shipping News. He wrote in about Captain Ed Montgomery. He told me that Ed is a captain who owns and operates the local pilot boat for the port of Duluth Superior at the far western tip of the Great Lakes. Ken wrote that he'd never thought of Ed as an overly sensitive guy. And while he'd heard that Ed had cancer, he'd put off calling him to ask about it since he didn't really find it very comfortable to do. Then, Ken writes, I got an email from Ed that blew me away. First of all, it got me up to date on his health and the treatment that he'd gone through. But as I read it again, wrote Ken, the email was also an instruction book on how we might approach people who have serious health problems. Advice from the other side, so to speak. And so I invited Ed Montgomery to join me, and we started our conversation talking about his life on the waterfront.
Yeah, it's not for the faint-hearted if you don't enjoy being outside and working in the weather. And you do work in all kinds of weather, from rain to brutal sun to snow and ice. And you're breaking ice with your vessels at times, and it can be quite challenging. We operate basically from late March till about Christmas. And then the Sioux locks up in Michigan close because of all the ice, and the shipping takes about a 60-day to 90-day hiatus, and we fix everything we broke, basically. So we get a little bit of time off in midwinter then.
So I'm imagining you as kind of a tough guy yourself. Fair enough?
Oh, I guess so. I'm not sure my wife would agree with you, but I guess I considered myself fairly tough, yeah.
Did that come along with the bad habits that sometime accompany that lifestyle, the smoking, cursing, drinking, staying out too late and stuff like that?
There certainly is, around the docks, enough of that, if you're a longshoreman or captain or whatever. But I didn't imbibe too much. As a matter of fact, the cancer that I was diagnosed with is actually known more of a smoker's and drinker's cancer, but I don't do either to speak of. So it was, as my doctor said, kind of a bolt of lightning.
Well, I noticed that you wrote at one point, regret for bad habits if they cause my health's bane, and I wondered if you were writing, if you were talking at that time about regrets for, for having been a smoker or a drinker at a time when you should have known better.
No, I was more referring to poor diet and high stress and lack of sleep and, all the time that running your own business around the clock.
Yeah, I was going to say, these are the small businessmen's curses, really.
Yeah, and we operate, 24-7, I could have four or five ships from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. and not get any sleep. And it was very common, and it still is to a point.
But it was an outdoors life that you were leading when you got your first diagnosis of cancer. Did it come as a shock to you?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were pretty stunned. I had had a swelling on my neck for a number of weeks and it didn't go down. Went and saw some doctors. They gave me some antibiotics. We thought that was, you know, we had it pegged. The thing with head and neck cancers is there's no pain, there's no feeling of it. You might have it for a very long time and not know it. You catch it early, and with chemo radiation, they can usually knock it out.
Well, what were they telling you? Were they saying, okay, first surgery, then chemo, then radiation? I mean, the whole nine yards. What was next?
I actually went to a ear, nose, and throat specialist by accident. I was referred there from my regular doctor. So the ear, nose, and throat doctor said, no, something's going on here. When you're a grown person, you don't have swollen glands. That's a kid's deal. Something else is going on here. So he wanted to put me under so I could take a good look with the camera and scope and whatnot. It came back malignant, once on my tonsil and one on my the base of my tongue. And they basically told me, you know, it's pretty extensive surgery, the treatment for this, because you've progressed and now a stage 3 or stage 4, which is pretty far along.
Yeah.
And they said, we do that surgery here. They told me I'd have, you know, probably a 6-7 hour surgery, and it ended up being 14 and a half hours I was on the table.
Wow. Are there doctors that are being straight with you about what your chances are? I mean, when you start talking about stage 3, stage 4, you're into a pretty serious level of cancer. Are they saying to you on the going into the operating room the first time, going into, you know, to facing what's wrong with your larynx, are they saying to you, you know, your chances aren't great here?
Yeah, they were straightforward, which I was grateful for. And they said, you know, we're not going to BS you here. It's too serious. And they said, on the other hand, you're relatively young. I was 49 when I was first diagnosed. Since you're in good health, you're strong. And our recommendation is to go with this with both barrels and be as aggressive as we can. We think you can take it. And we think you can handle it. And I said, well, all right, let's go.
After that, Ed Montgomery had radiation and chemo, but that was followed by 2 more tumors. And so that meant more chemo, a double dose.
Yeah, I guess I'm pretty tough, but they had me curled up like a baby. I was hurting. It was about 6 weeks of that. And after that, we went in for an appointment. They had a PET scan, and a doctor comes in and looks a little disconcerted, and I'm thinking, oh boy, this is bad news. And she says, how do you feel? And I said, well, and every time I ask that question by a doctor, it's usually bad news that follows it.
Yeah.
I said, oh, great, that question again. I said, I feel basically okay, kind of bent up from this chemo, but I feel basically okay. She said, well, we can't find anything. I said, what do you mean you can't find anything? She says, the tumors appear to be gone completely, disappeared. I said, that's impossible. Does that happen very often? She says, no, it doesn't, and we don't know why. When Jeannie and I looked at each other, and in our heart, we knew why. I can only say that through the grace of God and our prayers is that that was a result. They had rarely seen that on 2 sizable tumors like that in a matter of 6 weeks completely disappear. And they checked it visually with their scope, and It was true. They were gone.
And it was about this time that Captain Ed Montgomery wrote that email to friends. He'd been through a lot, and he wanted to bring friends up to date. But what those people came away with was a guide for how to deal with someone who's sick. Turns out Ed's advice was simple. Contact a sick friend. He told me of one man in particular, Big Butch.
Well, Big Butch, he's a longshoreman I work with, and he also fills in first mate on the pilot boat, and he's about 6'4", 6'5", about 280, strong as a bull, and a gruff guy. And he has a soft side and doesn't let anybody see, of course. He stopped by and he would call, and he was never afraid of shying away from me, where a lot of people did. There were friends that virtually just disappeared and never called, never stopped by, and for no particular reason that I can give, otherwise than they were afraid of, you know, the cancer and catch me on a wrong day.
Or maybe they were just afraid of being there and feeling really awkward and not knowing what to say, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure that was a big part of it. But I think that would be something that you need to get over. You never need to apologize for trying to support somebody.
Yeah.
Even if it is a bad day, they'll tell you. If it's a bad day and they're not feeling well, you know, they'll let you know.
It's the silliest thing, but you know, if a woman friend of mine were not feeling well, I'd have an easier time going to say hi and giving her a hug than I would walking into your hospital room and giving you a hug and saying, "How are you doing?" And then, you know, I mean, it should not be that way, but it is.
Yeah, no, and I'm the same way, and I'm no different. And I guess that's just something you kind of swallow and go do it. And Butch, you know, to his credit, did, and he was pretty much was the only one who really came and visited and tried to buck me up, you know, which was really helpful.
What did he say? What was it about his visit that sticks in your mind?
Basically, he wasn't afraid to joke around a little bit and have more of a normal conversation that we might have. It was really quite normal, and that was really what I needed.
From the first day we met, it's been like a brother relationship. He's easy to work with, and he's always out there looking for work. He was down at the mail, and I was up here, and the boats are up here. So I would call to see if we had work for the day, and I wanted to call and see how he was doing, too, you know, for what he was going through. And if there was work, then I would make sure that we had another guy to run the boat.
One of the things that Ed told me, Butch, was that of all his friends, mainly his guy friends, but of all his friends, you were the one who made the point of always staying in touch, not just about work, but just to sort of contact and check in with him. And that meant a lot to him. Did he ever say anything about that to you?
Yeah, he had told me that it meant a lot to him that out of all of his friends, I was the only one that was concerned of what was happening to him and checking on him. And that made me feel pretty good that he had come to me and told me that. And when I went to the hospital, it happened that Jeannie's parents and Ed's parents were there, and his dad started talking to me, and we were talking, and he goes, "We're waiting for Ed to wake up in the ICU, but come out of his anesthesia. Well, why don't you come in there and see if you can spark him awake?" So I went in, and I just took his hand, and I was talking to him, and I said, "Ed, if you can hear me, squeeze my finger." And says, "You got to wake up. We're waiting for you to wake up. And don't worry about the business that me and Dan and Pete were taking care of, trying to keep the business and the boat going, and also let him know that if he was worrying at all, that I was taking care of things." And then all of a sudden, one of the machines changed. His dad goes, "Look at this." Sure enough, he started to breathe on his own, and a couple hours later, he woke up. So I don't know. Maybe he heard me and enough to fight to wake up a little bit. Something worked.
You know, Butch, one of the things that I've been talking to Ed about is how it's often difficult for guys to relate to other guys when they're sick. Women seem to do this more instinctively than we do. And I just wonder if you have noticed that as well.
Yeah, well, like me, I was kind of brought up to work hard and I kind of know what you're saying as far as women and get together and talk, you know, more than men. But me and Ed, we have a good time when we're together. We joke around. We work, and we're tight, like a brother relationship.
That's Butch Radosovich there. Ed Montgomery told me that the other people who never get the credit they deserve are the primary caregivers. In his case, he says, the cancer brought him a lot closer to his wife, Jeannie.
I don't know how people do it who don't have a competent, attentive caregiver. But as far as my life changing, I got a scare later on. I went in for a normal routine checkup, and they said, "You've got more cancer in your throat. I says, are you kidding me? He says, no, we find three places it's back. I said, three places? I was free and clear a few months ago. And they said, oh, that's the way cancer is. We don't know what to tell you. And so we were pretty upset about it. And we said, well, we're going to go get a second opinion. And he said, that's fine. And they took another PET scan. And we went in the doctor's office after the scan. And he asked me, well, how are you feeling? And there's that question again. And I said, I'm feeling fine. What's going on? And he says, well, we don't really know because we can't find anything. Our scan shows nothing. And I was really upset because they had told me basically that I should basically get my affairs in order. And I didn't have long, is pretty much what they told me. So driving down, Jeannie's driving, and I'm kind of in a fog, and I'm picking out the hymns I want at my funeral and picking out my pallbearers. And, you know, had I done enough in my life? You know, was there more that I wanted to do? Did I do the right things? You want a downer sometime, think about picking out your own pallbearers. But it was a false alarm, and I was fine. And I told Jeannie, I said, if you think I was on fire before, watch me now. So
I'm thinking of the roller coaster that you've been on and thinking that was one up and down you didn't need.
Oh, absolutely. I'm trying to eat and sleep the best I can, and so we're just going to plug along. And until they tell me I'm going to die, I'm going to live.
Well, Captain Ed, it's been fun talking to you. I suspect you'll be piloting and tugboating those larger vessels around the Great Lakes for some time to come.
Well, thank you.
I talked with Captain Ed Montgomery last fall. Since then, he's had three checkups, and the doctors are giving him a clean bill of health. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ed's now pushing ahead with plans for a new marina with its own coffee shop, a place to stay warm on those cold Minnesota mornings. If you want to read that email that Ed wrote to his friends, you can find it at our website at thestory.org. Last week, we listened to a Your Story submission from Peter Polhammer. Peter had grown up with a great admiration for the baritone singer William Warfield. Warfield's best remembered for his version of the song, Old Man River. It was a performance that made a deep impression on Peter.
Well, that character Joe is one of the few black characters that exists in American theater or movie literature at that time that's not a step and fetch it character. And I think that's the thing, you know, you hear and you witness him sing this song.
Old Man River, that old man river, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps.
There's all this trouble and turmoil in the world, and my lot in life is to heave these bales of cotton day in, day out, and break my back and not get paid while other people prosper. Old Man River, he don't plant cotton, he don't, you know, he just keeps rolling along. It's and whatever happens to us in life, the river just keeps going. It's constant, it's there. The very end of the song, the last words, I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying.
I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But Old Man River,
he just keeps rolling along. And it's not a song of despair at all. I think it's a song of recognizing reality and being able to be at peace with it one way or another.
Danny in Pasadena was listening to Peter tell that story. He wrote in to say, your story about William Warfield touched me to my soul. as I was a voice student at the University of Illinois and took several lessons from Mr. Warfield when my usual voice teacher was on sabbatical. I had the pleasure of dining at Uncle Bill's house in Champaign with other voice students in the spring of 1983. If you have suggestions for stories or reactions to stories that you're listening to in the program, I'd like to hear from you. The fastest way to get to me is through our website at thestory.org. You can also leave me a message on our telephone at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.